KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Debtors Assembly in St. John's, Tuesday, June 21st at 4 p.m. under the bridge at Cathedral Park in Portland. Strike Debt is a nationwide movement of debt resistors fighting for economic justice and democratic freedom. This event also features a Strike Debt Portland potluck. Again, that's the Debtors Assembly in St. John's, Tuesday, June 21st, 4 to 7 p.m. at Cathedral Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And also by The Art of Living, presenting Get Happy Portland, a two-day immersive experience of breathing techniques and meditation by global humanitarian Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. Get Happy Portland takes place July 5th and July 6th at the Oregon Convention Center. Tickets and information are available at gethappyportland.org. Here comes the food show.
Some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect? Cause you can't.
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. Later in the show, I'll have an interview with Katie Furia, the program manager of the Double Up Food Bucks program created by the Farmers Market Fund. Double Up Food Bucks is a statewide snap match program giving people the ability to stretch their food dollars at farmers markets. At the end of the show, we'll be talking with Tad Seestedt from Ransom Wine and Spirits. Tad is taking an innovative approach to winemaking and distilling that focuses on the ingredients and some processes that have been largely forgotten by the industry. We'll also have our monthly check-in with Marisha Auerbach from Permaculture Rising. We're getting into summer and there's a lot happening in the vegetable garden. Marisha has some tips that will help us stay on top of all the tasks in the garden that will set us up for an abundant harvest. But first, we're going to take a journey east. The Lansu Chinese Garden is hosting events around the cuisines of Asia during the month of June. They range from subjects such as Bangkok street foods to delicacy of cured meats, to northern versus southern styled fried rice. Here to talk with us about this month of eating at the Chinese Garden is Gary Wilson, the Director of Events and Activities at the Lansu Chinese Garden. Gary, welcome to the food show.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me on.
So let's start with a bit of history. When was the Lansu Chinese Garden here in Portland founded?
The garden opened its doors in the year 2000. It took probably about 5 years before that to raise the money. And the sister city that we have with Suzhou helped raise that money. It cost $12.5 million to build, and we opened our doors in the year 2000.
And what is the role of the Chinese Garden in sharing Chinese culture with resident Portlanders?
You know, we're really proud of what we do. Not only is it an authentic replica of a Ming Dynasty Chinese garden, it's absolutely breathtaking if you've never been there, but we have really grown into what we feel is a community center. We have cultural activities all year long. Last year, we did over 600 free programs for our members and visitors, and we're pretty proud of that.
And why did you decide to have a month of food events at the Chinese Garden?
So as the program manager and certainly with the team of staff that we have, we meet usually in June to actually coordinate what our program themes are going to be for the next year. And we try to do a different cultural theme for every single month. So Last month was Asian Heritage Month, and we did cultural performances all month long, every weekend. But this is the third year in a row that we focused on cuisines. And for the first 2 years, it was called Cuisines of China. But as we grow and we build our partnerships with the community, we actually felt like it was time to expand that and just call it Cuisines of Asia.
So I want to talk about that. So these talks aren't just focused on Chinese cuisine. How did you choose which Asian cuisines to feature?
Well, it's truly actually just reaching out to the community to see who wants to partner with us. With expanding to calling it Cuisines of Asia, that opened our doors to actually then include Thai food, Malaysia food, Indonesian food, and certainly Chinese food. So myself and my program manager, Maggie Lim, truly just actually reach out to the community. We call the restaurant owners and we say, hey, this is our program. Would you like to participate? We couldn't do this programming without their support. And this year we have 13 restaurants that partnered with us to do these cooking demonstrations in the garden.
So we're midway through the month of June, and this programming has been going on since the beginning. Could you describe one of the programs that has happened
sure.
so far in June?
Sure. So we do these cooking demonstrations every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. They're all at 2:30. And last week we had Dragon Well Bistro here. Dragon Well Bistro is located in downtown Portland. They're just an absolutely delicious Chinese restaurant. Their chef was in the garden and teaching the visitors and the members how to make Mongolian beef, which absolutely was delicious. One of the visitors stepped into the pavilion after the talk and said, wow, this is the most fragrant space in the garden because it smelled so good. One of the items that they did was also teach us about a lotus chip. The lotus flowers are a beautiful water plant that grow in the summer in the garden, and you harvest the seed pod after it blooms and you shave it off and fry it. And they're the only restaurant in town that I'm aware of that actually serves these lotus chips, and they're absolutely delicious.
How does you describe somebody coming up and saying, okay, so this is the most fragrant part of the garden. How does it integrate with the rest of the Chinese garden?
Well, again, it's our focus on cultural programming. The garden, when the garden first opened, we felt like we were just a beautiful place to visit. And so for many years, you know, you buy a ticket, you come, or you be a member, and you come and you enjoy the beauty of the garden, the aesthetic of the garden. It was about 5 years ago when we changed our program format and went to this free programming. And I think the first year we did probably 50 or 60 programs. We are now up to over 600 programs through the year, and they vary. We do Tai Chi, Qigong, Mahjong. We do the month of cuisines. We do cultural performances. We partner with OCOM and NCNM, the local Chinese medicine colleges, and they do lectures twice a year in a series for Chinese medicine. It's actually pretty amazing what we do there that's free to the visitors and the members. And it's certainly all on our website, lansukgarden.org.
What have the partnerships been like with the restaurants that you've had come and present at the Chinese garden?
You know, all of the program partners that we have, it's truly a win-win relationship. Partnering with the garden gives them exposure with this incredible destination, but via our website and linking to their website, there's certainly a promotional value. But truly, I mean this sincerely, when almost every single program partner that we have at this time, and we have over 90 program partners, they're there because they love the garden. They want to support the garden. And so they're volunteering their time to do these programs, everything from teaching Mahjong or Qigong to these wonderful cooking demonstrations that we have this month.
So you said this is the third year for the cuisines of Asia. Well, this is the first year for Cuisines of Asia. And then you've done 2 years of Cuisines of China. What are people responding to the most when they come to these programs?
You know, I think it's the actually what I find sweet is not only do you just learn about a recipe, you know, you can learn how to cook Mongolian beef, but you do get the backstory of some of these restaurants, sort of where they came from, where they learned to cook, their heritage, where they grew up in or where their parents grew up when, how they immigrated to America. To me, that's actually sort of the hidden gem of these demonstrations. And a lot of our program partners are that way. But in particular, when we're partnering with these different Asian restaurants, you know, that's, I just find those stories just so heartwarming.
So they have an outlet to tell their stories, and then the people who can hear them and take them and find meaning in them.
It's a very personal connection. Most of these talks, we average anywhere from about 25 to 35 attendees at each presentation. And they're very fun, they're entertaining, but they're also delicious too. So
I think it's interesting that you're offering these talks and programs as free programs. What's the difference in having them as a free program versus if you were to charge for them?
You know, I've worked with the Garden for over 10 years. And when I first came on, programming was not the department that I was a part of. But we had a program manager, and we used to coordinate programs that had a fee base to it. The program manager would probably produce about anywhere from 4 to 6 or 8 programs a year. They were all fee-based, and the amount of time and energy it took to collect the registrations, collect the fees, we made an executive decision to change that format, offer the garden as a community space to anyone who wants to partner that is connected to Chinese heritage or Chinese, Chinese medicine, Chinese cuisine, anything like that, and make our space available as a community resource. So we're pretty proud of the partnerships that we've established in that area.
So people who visit the Chinese Garden can also take part in the Chopstick Challenge. I saw that was one of the events. So how do you suggest people train in order to succeed at the challenge and impress the people they're with?
Well, there's very little training required. I do recommend that really just come down and try it. When we develop our cultural programs, we always want to make sure that we're weaving in programs for families and children. And so we came up with the idea of Chopstick Challenge, and it's every Saturday and Sunday. And it's truly just a fun game where you experiment with chopsticks on moving a variety of items from one bowl to another, and they get harder as you go down the line. And then there you get a prize of a fortune stick if you get them all.
Is there anything that you've learned or gained more appreciation for about Asian cuisine having hosted these events?
Well, I definitely, we're so fortunate to live in Portland where food is a focus of this town with every single cuisine you could ever imagine. But it has, with the changes that have happened in Old Town, we do have several Chinese restaurants still in Old Town that are really wonderful. But, what we're trying to do is really make sure people stay connected to Old Town and connected to Chinese heritage and Asian culture. And so we're really proud of what we do inside the garden. But it's certainly a real joy to be able to partner with so many different restaurateurs in this town, and many of them are small businesses. We've got two of our program partners are food carts. They're so helpful and wonderful to work with.
Do you plan on featuring more food-related activities in the future?
You know, we haven't developed what our program lineup is for 2017 yet, but by all means, probably we'll repeat this. We do a program in October that is tea related. It's called The Essence of Tea, and we do an entire month of programs that are related to tea and poetry. Our partner, primarily one of our partners, is the Tao of Tea. They operate our tea house, and they do lectures and demonstrations on tea each week throughout the month, and they set up a tea kiosk that's a tea bazaar. They have raw teas, bulk teas, teapots that they sell.
How can someone take part in Cuisines of Asia event?
Well, certainly the best place to start is check out our website, lawnsuitgarden.org. That will, our program calendar lists all of our programming, but the Cuisines of Asia talks are every Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. They're all at 2:30 p.m., so you could check the calendar out to see which one might pique your interest, or certainly buy a membership. Our memberships are really affordable. They start at $60 for an individual and $75 for a family. And we really do encourage memberships because it allows you to come to the garden to all this programming for free. But certainly check our website out first, lawnsuitgarden.org.
And what do you? What's an exciting event that's coming up within Cuisines of Asia in the next couple weeks?
Well, definitely this coming Saturday, we have a restaurant called Kung Pao. It's the owner of Shandong. Shandong's been in Portland for many years, and they were part of our Cuisines of China for the last 2 years. They opened Kung Pao this year, and so he chose to identify that as the program partner to give them some more exposure. But they're going to be here this Saturday, and their food is just amazing. So I do encourage you to come down. That'll be a great demonstration this Saturday.
Well, Gary, it sounds like there's a lot of fun and exciting food activities at the Chinese Garden. And I thank you very much for coming on to the food show and talking about them.
Hey, you're so welcome. I appreciate it.
That was Gary Wilson, Director of Events and Activities at the Lensu Chinese Garden. You're listening to The Food Show. I'm Chris Siegel. In a moment, we'll be talking with permaculturist Marisha Auerbach about tips for the garden. Stay with us here at KBOO Community Radio.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. Gonna mulch it deep and low, gonna make it fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, please bless these seeds I sow. Please keep them safe below till the rains come tumbling down. Pulling weeds, picking stones, we are made of dreams and bones. Need a spot to call my own, for the time is close at hand. Grain for grain, sun and rain, find my way in nature's chain. Tune my body and my brain to the music of the land. Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. Gonna mulch it deep and low, gonna make it fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, please bless these seeds I sow. Please keep them safe below till the rains come tumbling down. Plant your rows short or long, season with a cheerful song. Mother Earth will make you strong if you give her loving care. Old Crow watching from a tree, got his hungry eye on me. In my garden I'm as free as that feathered thief up there. Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. At this point, we are in full stride working in the garden. This time of year, it may seem tough to keep up with all the plants growing in the garden, especially the weeds. There are a lot of moving parts to worry about in order to keep the soil healthy, keep the plants alive, and ensure a solid harvest. We've got Marisha Auerbach on the phone to help keep us organized as we approach the peak of the gardening season. Marisha, welcome back to The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris.
So we're getting to that point where you should have most of your full season crops in the ground, but what can folks still plant?
Well, it's about time to be putting in your warm season salad crops like purslane or amaranth. Succession plantings of beans can go in right now, or radishes, short season crops. I'm still going to put in some winter squash this week, but as I'm going to probably plant on Friday, and then those are going to be the last of my plantings for the summer until August comes around and I start putting in plants for the winter garden.
So do you have any special methods for planting beans or maybe corn?
Yeah, I like to soak the seeds first to sprout them earlier. So I'll just put them in warm water, and I'll rinse the water out every morning and refill it. And then every evening as well, I rinse it out. I'll stir it a little bit with a chopstick periodically throughout the day so it continues to be aerobic. And before I put the beans in the ground, I'll give them some legume inoculant to help them fix nitrogen in the soil.
And this is a good time to get some of the succession crops, you know, your radishes, your lettuce greens or salad greens. But what's the best way to plant, to direct seed when the soil tends to dry out quicker?
You know, what I usually like to do is I'll fly a sheet over my bed. I'll put some posts at the corners of each bed and then tie a sheet to it. And I tend to water with a watering wand, so I'll move it to the mist setting so that periodically throughout the day, the sheet gets wet, so it maintains a humid, shaded environment for seed germination beneath the sheet. And then it doesn't get too wet, but it doesn't dry out.
What can people do to take care of their longer season plants, like tomatoes, right now?
Well, it's good to make sure that they get watered regularly. I just actually mulched my tomatoes. It's good to make sure that you take the bottom leaves off your tomatoes so that water doesn't splash off the base of the soil and hit your tomatoes. When tomatoes stay wet, they tend to be more prone to fungal diseases. Another good strategy for the health of our plants is to water in the morning. We've been so fortunate for these rains in the last couple days. It hasn't been as ideal for plants like tomatoes and peppers, but it's been great for keeping the brassica crop on longer, as well as the lettuces are really thriving in my garden right now, and it's been great for germination. So I try to water in the morning, early in the morning, because then the plants can take in that water in the morning before their stomata close for the heat of the afternoon. If you water your garden in the evening, that's when fungal disease tends to proliferate. So that's why I try not to water in the evening. If we lived in Colorado or somewhere that's an arid environment and we didn't have such damp conditions in the evenings, it might be better to water in the evening. But for us in the Pacific Northwest, it's better to water in the morning.
So I have been harvesting quite a bit lately, and I'm wondering if there are methods for harvesting crops that allow you to get the most out of the plant.
Yeah, you know, I teach this garden class once a month at People's Food Co-op, and I have my students repeat after me with the mantra, pick it small, pick it often. So I'll tend to go through my garden about every 3 days and do a pick of all my major crops. By picking things small, you're stimulating them to continue to produce. Plants just want to be able to set seeds so they can ensure that their survival will continue until the following year by successfully creating that next generation of seed. So when we pick our plants young, pick young zucchinis, it stimulates more production of flowers and more production of zucchini. Other plants that I treat like this are cucumbers and tomatoes and peas and beans, all of these things that are, the more you pick them, the more you get. It's the same with leaves, too, with lettuces. I tend to pick the leaves off the lettuces rather than harvesting a whole head, and it encourages them to produce more leaves.
What type of pests should we be looking out for right now?
Well, I'm expecting a terrible season of aphids this year since it didn't really get that cold this winter again, and they never really died. Also, whitefly tend to proliferate in that heat like the aphids do. There's certain plants that really don't like those hot conditions and prefer not to be in the garden in the heat of the summer and are more cool season crops. And key plants like this are broccolis and cauliflower, cabbage, kale, and Brussels sprouts. So all of these plants are prone to aphids. I try to prevent an aphid infestation by planting them in a suitable microclimate where they get eastern morning sun, maybe some southern sun, but definitely protected by shade from the hot western sun. So those are the key pests. I've had a terrible year with the currant fruit fly in my landscape, so I picked all the currants off of my bushes. The currant fruit fly lays its eggs in the currant as the flowers are developing, as the fruit is developing, and then the fruit falls prematurely so that the larva makes its way to the soil. They overwinter in your soil and then come out as the next generation of fruit flies. The spotted-winged Drosophila has a similar pattern, and that's one to look out for with your raspberries. So raspberries are another thing that I pick every 3 days. I try to make sure that I don't have any overripe fruit, as the spotted-winged Drosophila likes the ripe and the overripe fruit. And it seems like when I go to pick a raspberry that has a spotted-winged Drosophila larvae in it, it practically just melts to the ground.
So I know we're just hitting summer and that winter seems a long way off, but is there anything we should be thinking about now to get ready for winter?
For those gardeners that love Brussels sprouts, now is the time to get the Brussels sprouts in the ground. But the trick, as I said, with Brussels sprouts is to protect them from the heat of the sun in the summer with some shade. And then once it gets cooler, have your Brussels sprouts in a state where they have a really solid root foundation and they're just ready to go into the winter. And that's what we need to do to get those Brussels sprouts that we like to have for Thanksgiving or into December and January. I love Brussels sprout gratin, but it's so hard to grow Brussels sprouts. It's also good to set aside space for the winter garden. Many of the crops are going to go in the fall, or plants will go in August and September. Some other plants it's good to just set aside and make sure that you're keeping things for later. I'll mulch my carrots and my beets and my potatoes so that those hold throughout the winter in the garden. And so I don't harvest too many carrots in the summer so that I know that I have carrots for the winter soups as they come.
What educational events do you have coming up?
Well, I have my last plant sale of the season is going to be this Saturday at my house. We also do an open house and a garden tour, so that's going to be from 1 to 4. And my workshop series will go into the next round of classes. The next one is on the first Tuesday of July, and we're going to be looking at berries, herbs, and water catchment. And on Tuesday, I'm starting up my permaculture design course at Portland Community College. And I think there still might be a space or two available on that.
And where can people find information?
All of those events are at permaculturerising.com.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming back on the Food Show, Marisha.
Thanks, Chris. We'll talk next month.
That was Marisha Auerbach from Permaculture Rising giving us tips for the garden. You're listening to the Food Show. In a moment, we'll be talking with Katie Furia about the Double Up Food Bucks program, a program that incentivizes SNAP users to buy food from farmers market. Stay with us.
Nighthawks at the diner, Emma's 49er. There's a rendezvous of strangers around a coffee in the night. All the gypsy hacks and the insomniacs, now the paper's been read. Now the waitress said, eggs and sausage and a side of toast. Coffee and a roll, hash browns are what easy. Chili in a bowl with burgers and fries. What kind of pie? It's a graveyard charade, it's a late shit masquerade. And it's 2 for a quarter, dime for a dance. Woolworth rhinestone, diamond earrings, and a sideways glance. Now the register rings, now the waitress sings. Side of toast, coffee in a row, hash browns over easy.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. Farmers markets are great places to make community connections. You can have the experience of meeting up with friends and family for lunch, while also meeting the farmer who grows the food you're about to eat. But markets have been perceived as places limited to people with high incomes who are able to pay premium prices for food. Regional farmers markets, with the help of the Farmers Market Fund, are working to make markets more accessible to everyone. I'm joined by Katie Furia, the manager of the Double Up Food Bucks program, which was created by the Farmers Market Fund. Katie, welcome to The Food Show.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me.
So before we jump into the Double Up Food Bucks program, I want to talk about farmers markets in general. What is the role of farmers markets in addressing food security?
Sure. Well, you touched on it a bit in the intro, but farmers markets offer a more personal and interactive food shopping experience and are a fun community event where families can spend time engaging around healthy local food, a place where children are inspired to try new foods, learn about growing food and cooking it. And because the experience of shopping for food is so much more fun, it gives people a positive feeling about eating healthy. And as far as addressing food insecurity, that's really the role of the SNAP program. SNAP is our country's first line of defense against hunger, and by farmers markets accepting SNAP, which the majority of them do, especially in the Portland metro area, almost all of them accept SNAP benefits, it makes these fun community events and this healthy local food more accessible to those with a tighter food budget.
So in the grand scheme of things, the amount of food that is being sort of distributed through farmers markets is relatively small. So what do you see as where the farmers market fits within that system, within the food system?
Well, farmers markets are one of the few connection points where urban people have with the people who grow their food. So they're important social and economic touch points for the whole community. And farmers markets in Oregon are one of the primary ways that small family farms sell directly to consumers. And that access to buyers allows the farm to diversify their crop production. And now with so many markets being year-round, those farmers can grow year-round, maintain their employees, and have income for their family year-round as well.
And you've mentioned the SNAP program. You worked at Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon as the SNAP outreach manager.
Correct.
Could you give us a history of SNAP in Oregon?
Oh, I wasn't prepared for that one. Well, SNAP's been around for the 70s, and I believe it was in the 90s. The hunger rates came back, and Oregon was at the top for the most insecure in the country. And so the Oregon Hunger Task Force came together and really made an effort to tackle hunger in Oregon, and a big part of that was SNAP outreach. And in the recession just recently, we saw a real surge in SNAP participation, just with people losing their jobs and real hardships for families. We've slowly been seeing the participation in SNAP coming down a little bit as jobs are coming back, but there's still quite a few Oregonians, 700,000 currently, who are participating in the SNAP program.
And what are some of the barriers to participating in the SNAP program?
Oh, some folks think that it may be too hard to apply, when the truth is you can actually go online. Offices in Oregon are really very friendly and try to make it as easy as possible. Also perception that sometimes they may not get that many benefits to make it worth it, but the average benefit for a family of four, oh, I shouldn't state this, my numbers might be off, but is in $100 to $200. And really, it's great to help families supplement supplement their food budget as they're getting back on their feet and getting jobs back.
And so there have been SNAP match programs at farmers markets. What has been the impact of those programs?
Yeah, so SNAP match programs have existed in Oregon since about 2008. The Lentz International Farmers Market in Southeast Portland was the first one to offer a match program. And SNAP match programs offer what we consider a win-win-win. So families, low-income shoppers are able to bring home more healthy food. Farmers are making more money, and then more money is staying in the local economy, which strengthens communities. So any program that would offer one of those things would be pretty fantastic. But the fact that this program offers all three makes it really special. And last year in Oregon, we sent out SNAP customer surveys to all of our planned Double Up Food Bucks markets and found that SNAP shoppers were purchasing 92% more fruits and vegetables because of the matching programs that were currently in place. And most of those were a $5 match. And now with Double Up Food Bucks, we'll be increasing that to $10. So we're hoping to see even bigger increases.
So I managed the St. John's Farmers Market for a few years.
Yes.
And so I know, you know, the impact. I've seen the impact of the SNAP Match program, but I also know it's challenging for the individual markets to do the fundraising to create the funds so that they're able to support a SNAP Match program. So tell us about a little bit about the Double Up Food Bucks program and what it's intended to do for markets.
As far as funding?
As far as funding, as far as, sort of taking that burden off of the individual mm-hmm. markets and creating this broader program that supports all markets.
Sure. So to get to the funding, this program really came to be when Farmers Market Fund was awarded the Food Insecurity Nutrition Incentive Program grant, which is a federal grant. And then more than half of the program is also funded from local funders within the state. So we were able to take some of that financial burden off of the markets by granting out money directly to the markets to then reimburse the farmers. Although we do consider local community support really important for the program and its sustainability as well. So markets are also still working within their community to try to raise some local funds as well. But we provide all the training for the program, all the outreach materials and the currency, and just really work closely one-on-one with the markets to get the program off the ground.
So I want to dive into the program itself.
Yeah.
How do Double Up Food Bucks work?
Sure. So first thing a SNAP customer would need to do would be to go to the market information booth. There they would then swipe their Oregon Trail card for as much SNAP as they think they want to spend at the market that day. So they will swipe their Oregon Trail card. They would then receive wooden tokens for the amount they swipe for to then go purchase SNAP eligible foods at the market. And that can be fruits and vegetables, bread, cheese, eggs, meat, baked goods, jams, jellies, honey, whole bunch of stuff. They would also receive a matching amount of Double Up Food Bucks up to $10 to then spend on additional fruits and vegetables at the market. So the customer, say they would swipe their card for $10, they would walk away with $20 worth of currency to buy food at the market.
And then you kind of said it, but what exactly can you get when you have your Double Up Food Bucks dollars?
So the Double Up Food Bucks are for fruits and vegetables only. That was a stipulation of this federal grant, and that's for fresh, dried, or frozen without the addition of any salts or sugars or oils.
And who can take advantage of the program? Who qualifies for Double Up Food Bucks?
All SNAP participants. So they don't need to request the match when they go to the market. They don't need to sign up for anything. They simply need to use their SNAP benefits at the market and they will receive the match.
And what does the Farmers Market Fund hope to accomplish with the program?
Well, pretty simply, we're trying to increase the amount of SNAP dollars that are spent at area farmers markets and also increase the number of SNAP households that are spending their benefits at the markets.
And how do they plan on measuring that goal? How do they know when they've accomplished what they want?
Sure. Well, each of our markets is closely tracking all of the SNAP transactions and the amount of SNAP and Double Up that's distributed and redeemed by vendors. And we're also doing customer and vendor surveys. So we're able to collect all that information and put it together.
So there have been a lot of markets that have done SNAP Match programs, and each market has kind of had different ways of administrating those programs. With the Double Up Food Bucks program, it sounds like it's going to become uniform. What markets are participating in this program?
So we have 51 farmers markets around the state of Oregon. We're in 17 counties, and about 20 of those are in the Portland Tri-County area. Yes, you hit it right on the head that it is making the program more uniform. So similar program rules, similar branding, a $10 match at all of the markets. That Double Up Food Buck currency that the SNAP customer receives can be then used at all of the participating farmers markets. And the best way for folks to find out if it's at their favorite market is to visit doubleuporegon.org, which has a map and a list of all the participating markets.
And so then just to clarify, so if I were to go to a market and I got my double up food bucks and I didn't spend them all there, I could then potentially take those and use them at a different market.
Correct. So the wooden snap tokens you get for your snap swipe need to be spent at that market, but then the double up food bucks can be spent at any of the 51 farmers markets. So if you pick up some food bucks down at the Tigard Farmers Market, but you love the strawberry guy up here at the Lloyd Farmers Market, you can bring them there and spend them.
So how are you getting information about the program out to people?
So we printed a lot of flyers and posters, which are being distributed in communities around our farmers markets. So through community partners, DHS offices, food banks, senior centers, community spaces, to really get the word directly to the SNAP customers. The farmers markets have also been doing a lot of promotion on their own, especially through social media and through some of their outreach materials. And as I mentioned, doubleuporegon.org not only lists all the markets, but has more details on the how-to of the program and some frequently asked questions.
Are there hopes to expand or build the Double Up Food Bucks program for the future?
Absolutely. So we're constantly working on additional funding to keep this program going. Ideally, I'd love every market in Oregon that would like to participate to be able to offer the program. I'd love to see a program in every one of the counties, so definitely working toward expanding it.
And what other work is the Farmers Market Fund working on to strengthen farmers markets across Oregon?
So right now we really are mainly focused on Double Up Food Bucks and raising additional funds for that. It's a model, a program that we know works. And we're also working to help local communities to find local funding for the program. You know, as I mentioned, federal funds are fantastic, but it really takes a community working together to combat hunger. We have some other smaller programs, some local markets that we fund, some of their, for instance, voucher programs. They'll give low-income shoppers vouchers to shop at the market. The Cully Farmers Market does a really neat senior volunteer program, which they then give them vouchers. So we are offering some seed funds for some other small programs as well. But the primary focus is on Double Up Food Bucks.
So this is a brand new program, and we're sort of at the front end of the farmers market season. What's the initial feedback? How is it working out?
So far, so good. We started in January with four pilot markets, one in Portland, Oregon City, Corvallis, and Roseburg, and saw increases in SNAP transactions from the previous year at all of those. And then from a farmer side, I was speaking with one of the markets in Southeast Portland last week, one of the market managers, who said the vendors are like, wow, this is the most money I've ever made at a farmer's market ever since we've introduced Double Up Food Bucks. So we're definitely seeing the positive increase on that side as well.
And hopefully it's changing that perception now. You know, more and more people, as farmers markets become more accessible, that'll change over time.
Mm-hmm. Trying to make all the wonderful food there more affordable for everyone.
So how can people learn more about the Farmers Market Fund itself?
They can visit farmersmarketfund.org.
Great. Katie, thank you so much for coming on the Food Show and talking about the Double Up Food Bucks program with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Katie Furia, manager of the Double Up Food Bucks program at the Farmers Market Fund. You are listening to The Food Show. In a moment, we'll be talking with Tad Seasted from Ransom Wine and Spirits about his innovative approaches to winemaking and distilling. Stay with us.
Songs I wanna play. Load up the car, leave our home behind. Going to be fine today. Good morning, all the vendors say. Here come the crowds. Hey, it's market time. Merry twinkle in their eyes.
sky. Sunshine is good and rain is oh so kind. If the seed is planted right, and we get no frost.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. Tad Seasted has been working in the wine industry for decades. In 1997, he started Ransom Spirits and added wine to his offerings in 1999. Tad has been a part of this new and vibrant wave of craft winemaking and distilling in Oregon and has led the charge for certain innovative practices. Tad, welcome to The Food Show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you aren't just a vintner or a distiller. It seems like you enjoy wearing many hats. What exactly do you do at Ransom Wine and Spirits?
Well, we're a farm, winery, and distillery. So we have, you know, we grow a range of different things here, mostly barley that we use for whiskey and gin. We have a small vineyard and a small orchard, and we grow some of the botanicals and herbs that we use to make vermouth. So as far as beverages are concerned, we do a pretty wide range of both wines and spirits, different types.
So I guess I should have added farmer to that list of the things you do, the hats you wear.
It's one of them.
So how long have you been creating wine and spirits?
I started working in wineries in 1993.
And what was that early experience like?
It was really good. It was here in Oregon. I had kind of prepped myself for a few years to make a career switch into winemaking, and I wanted to give it a test to see if it's really what I wanted to do, and the first year was great, and I'm still doing it.
What were you doing before you made the leap into, you know, your career shift into making wine?
Well, I grew up on a farm in upstate New York in the Finger Lakes region, and at some point decided that that's really not what I had wanted to do with my life, and moved to New York City and went to college and had a series of both government and corporate jobs, and realized that I really didn't fit in an office environment and wanted to get back outside and have more of an agriculturally based life.
And after you had that early experience, how did you decide to start your own business?
I think it was always in my mind. It's something I'd thought about for a long time. I suppose that transition went pretty fast, although it seemed to take a long time. I started my business after working in the industry for 4 years.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the wine season, what you do at Ransom, some of your practices. But we've had an interesting season with the early heat wave. What's in the cards for this year's crop of grapes?
Well, I mean, it's always too early to call it until it's over, and we're still a long ways away. You know, where we are out here on my farm, it's a relatively cool site. So we're just finishing up bloom. We'd say if everything works normal in around 100 days from now, we would be harvesting our grapes. But it's been cool the last week or so. I mean, I think maybe unseasonably, depending on how you look at it, maybe this is what Oregon is normally like or was normally like in May and June. But I think that, you know, kind of depends really on what happens for the next 2 or 3 months. And certainly the spring got off to an early start, not quite as early as last year, but earlier than normal. So there's a lot that's left to happen still, and we just kind of have to wait and see.
So what potential impact does that early start have on the later in the season?
Well, it would generally mean we'd be harvesting early, you know, and I would say, you know, normal, maybe old school Oregon harvest, we'd be looking at starting to pick grapes first week of October, maybe from the warmer sites the last week of September. But, you know, if things track on schedule this year, there'll probably be people picking in the first half of September.
So I want to talk about some of your practices. And with your wines, you don't like to use grapes that are grafted onto rootstock that's resistant to phylloxera. And one, could you explain to us what phylloxera is and why you've made that decision?
Okay. Well, I wouldn't say that I don't like to use grapes that aren't grafted. I think it's a preference.
A preference, sure.
And part of that preference is related to the age of the vine. So I would say, you know, the majority of winemakers, if they had their druthers, would work with older vines rather than younger vines, although there are a lot of other variables involved, you know, such as, you know, the site where the grapes are grown and the characteristics of that. I think for me, you know, over the years, I've just gravitated, or my palate has either gravitated, or it's just what I seem to prefer are those older vines. And of course, in Oregon, they are almost entirely planted on their own roots. And what that means is that they're basically stuck in the ground, that, you know, they grow their own roots just as they used to do for thousands of years. But phylloxera is a pest. It's a nematode, but I guess a good way to put it for people who aren't, you know, so into the whole vineyard and wine thing would be it's a root louse. And they basically, it's a little microscopic bug that eats the roots of grape plants, and they can eat the roots faster than the plant can regenerate them. They don't kill grapevines immediately. It can take a number of years, but normally once you have that phylloxera in a vineyard that's on its own roots, the vineyard, its life expectancy is very limited. It might, you know, it could be a few years, it could be maybe as long as 10 years, but the vines start dying and eventually succumb.
And so it's a preference for you to use the grapes on the rootstock that's not phylloxera resistant. I want to ask you a question. I've read something that you've written about native yeast and natural wine. What does it mean to you to create natural wine, and how would you describe the wines you make?
Well, it's a big topic and a big question, so I will do my best to nutshell an answer. I think that, you know, really, you know, native wine is an interesting term, and, you know, in my mind, it's a little bit paradoxical because it insinuates that some wine can be made in a natural way and some wine in an unnatural way. I think that is the big issue. And essentially, at least from my reckoning, all wine is natural. All wine will, you know, we grow our grapes, yeast ferments the wine. There are variables for how those grapes are grown or where the yeast comes from or how it's developed or what kind of yeast. But in, you know, essentially, wine is all natural. What would make it unnatural in my mind is what happens after that. You know, there are a lot of things that happen in wineries that have happened for decades or generations. There's also a lot of things that are new, you know, new technology, and part of the winemaking process is, you know, what we do with the wine after it's fermented. And I think, to me, that is really where wines can be, you know, can remain natural or maybe become something else. And that, you know, they're fining agents. You can add acid, take out acid. There are all sorts of additives that are, I guess, probably flavor related, but also, you know, palate and mouthfeel related, you know, different types of filtering and so on. And it's a really a complex thing, a complex idea, you know, what is a natural wine, and difficult to really answer in a short amount of time.
Definitely. I want to talk a little bit about your spirits, and you grow some of your own grains. And so I want to know, what's the importance of between the grains and the quality of the grains versus the barrels that you use when aging the spirits?
I guess, I mean, our focus in the distillery is certainly on the grain and the fermentation. And I guess, again, I don't think it's better grains making a better spirit necessarily, but that different grains make very different spirits. And, you know, our labeling laws in the U.S. are a little funny. They probably are just about anywhere, you know, whereas we might call, if we're going to use whiskey as an example, we would call a whiskey what it is based on where it came from, not necessarily what it was made from. And I think that's a kind of a major departure and just from a sense of logic. But also, you know, as far as having a consumer understand what they're actually putting in their bodies and what they're tasting. So, you know, our focus is to use, you know, many different grains, but, you know, we'll put on our label what grains we're using. We don't have secrets as far as what our mash bills are. One thing I'd like to say, it's kind of funny, but, you know, I think there are two reasons to keep secrets. And, you know, one is because there's nothing to tell, and two is because there's something to hide. But certainly in the spirits industry, there's a lot of, you know, kind of historical smoke and mirrors, a lot of government regulation, and a lot of it really doesn't make sense.
So I'm going to ask you one more big question, and we're actually almost out of time. We got about 30 seconds, but so I'm going to ask you a big question that I'm going to have you answer in a short answer. Where do you see the wine and spirit industry in Portland and Oregon heading?
Well, I mean, it's growing, and I think what I see and what I would hope to see is a continuation of more diverse products being made, both in the wine and the spirit end. And I think, you know, we're a new industry here on both ends of that spectrum, and there's a lot of maturing yet to do. And I think, you know, adding a different range of products and possibilities for the drinking consumer is where we're going, and hopefully where it will continue to go.
Tad, thank you so much for joining me on the Food Show.
Thank you.
That was Tad Seasted from Ransom Wine and Spirits. And that's it for this episode of the KBOO Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived on the new KBOO website at kboo.fm. I want to thank our guests Gary Wilson, Marisha Auerbach, Katie Furia, and Tad Seasted for being on today's show. I also want to thank our amazing board operator, Tammy. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives, and don't forget to tune in again the third Wednesday of July for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away? Cause it ain't the right size or perfect, cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good. Cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dying. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. Need for the world.
And with that, that's the end of public affairs programming for this morning, Wednesday morning. And before we go to the KBOO Noon News, I need to pass along a little correction for you. Earlier, we announced an upcoming talk by Dalit Baum, Israeli researcher, scholar, feminist, and social justice activist, on everything you always wanted to know about BDS. Well, that announcement failed to give the time of the talk. It is this Friday, June 17th at 7 p.m. at Tabor Space, and that's at 5441 Southeast Belmont in Portland. Thank you so much for tuning into Community Radio KBOO Portland this morning. And with that, we'll move on. Whoops. Move on to the KBOO Noon News. Thanks for tuning in. Hey, stay tuned for jazz at the top of the hour.
Thank you. This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, June 15th, 2016. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, the Naked Goddess Swim started in 2013 when a few Portland women shed their clothes and inhibitions to swim as goddesses in the full moonlight. The swim will return again on Saturday, August 20, to the relatively secluded east bank of the Wilmette River near the Hawthorne Bridge, when 120 naked women are expected to enter the water at midnight.
Homer Williams, one of Portland's most prominent developers, and a partner, Dyke Damas, are looking for a location in northwest Portland to build a $100 million homeless facility. They are hoping the location will serve as a one-stop shop for 1,400 homeless people.